Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
Translation: Maharaja Parikshit was a realist like the bees who only accept the essence of a flower. He knew perfectly well that in this age of Kali, auspicious things produce good effects immediately, whereas inauspicious acts must be actually performed to render effects. So he was never envious of the personality of Kali. Purport: the age of Kali is called the fallen age. In this fallen age, because the living beings are in an awkward position, the Supreme Lord has given some special facilities to them. So by the will of the Lord, a living being does not become a victim of a sinful act until the act is actually performed. In other ages, simply by thinking of performing a sinful act, one used to become a victim of the act. On the contrary, a living being in this age is awarded with the results of pious acts simply by thinking of them. Maharaja Parikshit, being the most learned and experienced king by the grace of the Lord, was not unnecessarily envious of the personality of Kali because he did not intend to give him any chance to perform any sinful act. He protected his subjects from falling prey to the sinful acts of the age of Kali, and at the same time he gave full facility to the age of Kali by allotting him some particular places. At the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that even though all nefarious activities of the personality of Kali are present, there is a great advantage in the age of Kali. One can attain salvation simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. Thus, Maharaja Parikshit made an organized effort to propagate the chanting of the Lord's holy name, and thus he saved the citizens from the clutches of Kali. It is for this advantage only that great sages sometimes wish all good for the age of Kali. In the Vedas also it is said that by discourse on Lord Krishna's activities, one can get rid of all the disadvantages of the age of Kali. In the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is also said that by the recitation of Srimad Bhagavatam, the Supreme Lord becomes at once arrested within one's heart. These are some of the great advantages of the age of Kali, and Maharaja Parikshit took all the advantages and did not think any ill of the age of Kali, true to his Vaishnavite cult. In this verse, we find the word Sara, or derivatives of that word, used twice. Sara means essence. Parikshit Maharaj was learned and wise, and thus he appreciated that if one can understand the essential teaching of Shastra concerning Kali Yuga, and then he will understand that Kali Yuga, although in all other respects bad, is actually very good. Kale dosha nida, as Parikshit Maharaj was to be instructed by Shukdev Maharaj, but it appears that Parikshit Maharaj already appreciated the quality of Kali Yuga, that good acts, if simply thought of, give a pious result, whereas bad acts have to actually be performed to produce sinful reactions. So this is a good quality of Kali Yuga, but there's something better which Shukadev will describe to Parikshit Maharaj. Kale dosha nidhe rajan asti hi eko mahan guna kirtanad eva krishnasya mukta sangha parang vrajet. Kali Yuga is undoubtedly an ocean of faults. Those who have seen the ocean, I suppose everyone here has seen the ocean. In the modern age, people move around, although in the past, most people would not have seen the ocean, and they'd be in the Dr. Frog position of not being able to imagine how vast it is. So, in the ocean, it's vast. If you're in the middle of the ocean, all you can see is water in all directions. And you can go, if you're sailing on a ship over the ocean, you can go for days without seeing land. So like that, Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults. And it's also not only wide, but it's practically unlimitedly deep. So deep. So just lots of water. So in Kali Yuga there are lots of faults, a great ocean of faults. But there is one great quality which overshadows or outweighs the faults for those who know this secret, that by chanting the names of Krishna, one can be free from all the bad effect, not only of Kali Yuga, but of material life altogether, and go to the supreme abode. Therefore, kaling sabhajyantyarya gunagya sarabhagina yatra sankirtana nevai aiva sarva swarthobhilabhyate. Those who are actually understanding what are the qualities and faults of Kali Yuga, who are, again the word, sarabhagina, one those who can accept the essence. They worship Kali Yuga. Such distinguished persons worship Kali Yuga because they know that in Kali Yuga, simply by Krishna Sankirtan, all desirable objects can be obtained. So Parikshit Maharaj, he was accepting the essence, he was yet to be informed what the essence of the essence is, just like we find in Srimad Bhagavatam is described. Sarva vedeti hasanam saram saramudaharitam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence and of the essence of all the Vedas and the Puranas, all the Vedic literature. So the essence is Vaidaischa Sarve Arahameva Vedaha. The essence is of the Vedas is to understand Krishna, but even though Krishna is described elsewhere in the Vedic literature, Srimad Bhagavatam gives the essence of the essence in presenting pure devotional service to Krishna without any ambiguity or apparent contradiction within its text. So the essence of the essence of Kali Yuga is that chanting of the holy names of Krishna is particularly efficacious in this age. Maharaj Parikshit accepted the good quality of Kali Yuga. Therefore, he was a realist. Srila Prabhupada has translated this as realist, which is an interesting translation because what Srila Prabhupada calls a realist is just the opposite of the generally accepted understanding of what a realist is. Generally, a realist in what we might call standard English, if there is such a thing, a realist is considered the opposite of an idealist. A realist is someone who is concerned with the reality of this world. I mean, this is real, this world, right? And we live here. And we got to do whatever is required to make our situation better in this world. And realists have, they're materialists. And they have little patience with idealists who talk of worlds beyond, spiritual life. And realists reject this as unsubstantiated idealism. The hope that there is a place where there is a God who's good and everyone's good. Let's be realistic. This world is not good, but you've got to be strong and make your position strong and make the best you can of this world. Don't be idealistic. But Srila Prabhupada uses the term realist in a sense that the so-called realists would consider unrealistic or idealism. Actually, to be a realist, first of all, you should know what is real. The so-called realists, they presume that what is real is what we can easily and immediately perceive. Why that should be, they don't give any explanation, but they say, well, we can only deal with what we know. And they presume that all that is to be known is within the scope of their sense perception and extended from their sense perception, their rationalizing on the basis of what they observe. So it's actually an extremely foolish proposition, because to consider that all that is real is within the scope of our tiny, within the scope of our highly limited senses and highly limited intelligence is not at all a realistic proposition. So actually the real realist, as Srila Prabhupada states here, is one who understands not just the gross, but also the subtle. And the subtle, even beyond matter. Why should we presume that all of reality is only matter? So, Maharaj was a Maharaj Parikshit. He was a realist in the true sense of the term. Like the bees who only accept the essence of a flower. The bee goes to a flower and takes the pollen, which is a powerful substance from that honey is produced. Concentrated food. So the bees, they take the pollen. They don't take the stem or the stamen or the petals or the seeds that are produced in the flower. Or they come before that. They take the pollen. So in the same way, Maharaj Parikshit was a realist. He took the essence. He didn't take the bad qualities. He took the good qualities. He accepted the good qualities of Kali Yoga. Kali Yoga is particularly an age of falsity. The whole material world is on the basis of falsity. That is the opposite of realism. The falsity of identifying oneself in any other terms but those of that I am an eternal servant of Krishna. This is falsity. And from that expands the idea to enjoy this material world through the senses, through the mind and the senses. This is all false. But in Kali Yuga, the atmosphere is one of falsity, intense falsity. False is false. How can false be intense? Either something is right or it's wrong. It's a miss is as good as a mile. There's an English saying. If you're shooting at the target and you miss it by 1 millimeter, you missed it. And if you miss it by 1 kilometer, it would be pretty difficult to do that. You still missed it. You get the same amount of points, which is zero, in the shooting competition. So, when we say very false or intensely false, well, what does that mean? We can say there's a near miss and a great miss. So, although the ultimate rating is zero, still, a near miss might be considered better than a great miss. So when we say intense falsity, false is false. If it's wrong, it's wrong. But the whole atmosphere is surcharged with an atmosphere of falsity in various ways, inasmuch as there's very little concern for what is actually the truth. In all spheres, in all respects. Although it's said that in Kali Yuga, truth is the one leg standing of Dharma. But it's under severe attack also. Because deceit, cheating, this is normal in human society. Therefore, contracts have to be drawn up. Manidha Prabhu told me that in the course of his travels in Sweden, he once came across a lawyer, an old man, retired lawyer, who said that in his youth, lawyers didn't have so much work to do. It's civil lawyers, because people would make a deal just like, I sell you this house, or whatever, and that was it. Handshake means that was it. The deal was done. Whatever they agreed on. Okay, I'll pay you so many kronas in such and such a time, and you can take possession of, the ex-owner says, and then, okay, give me a down payment this much, and you can take possession immediately. So you take possession, and you pay off the rest. And there's no question of cheating. It didn't even enter people's minds. But nowadays, the lawyer said, every single clause, you have to write it down carefully, inspect it very carefully, because people are always looking for a way to cheat. Even still in some places, and probably in Croatia in the villages like that, isn't it? Maybe not in house selling, but in smaller deals. It would be actually, for selling a house, there has to be some legal work for transference of the deed and all this, but even I heard, don't have much experience, but in small town America like that, it's still like that. Not in New York City or Los Angeles, for sure. Two winters ago, near Tuvela, 2 hours drive, we went to some small town, and I was talking about in a lecture. Yeah, I was talking. Small town means very small, and just surrounded by villages. And I said that. Probably a short time ago, you wouldn't think anything of leaving your door open and going out, but nowadays times have changed. They said, no, we're still doing that. We can still do that. We don't bother to. When I was traveling in Ireland in my youth, it was just a normal thing in the villages. People leave their doors open, and there's no one in the house. The door's wide open. No one's in the house. They may go out to the shop and then spend a couple of hours gossiping. It's a famous old Irish pastime. And then they come back, and there's who comes to the village? It's only the local people. A village means, 15 houses or something. 15 houses and 12 bars. It's an Irish. All the houses are bars. So that was there. They didn't. No one came from outside. And even if they did, call them in. It's dinner time. Call them in. Feed them. Like that. The times have changed where people can't even trust their neighbors. And on the door there has to be security system, and then if someone knocks on the door, you have to open it and look first of all. They have this fisheye. What's that called? Fisheye what? What's it called? Viewer or something we could call it. It's because if you open if there's a little slot to open it, you know, they could put a gun in. So you have a little fisheye, and you can see the whole hallway and everything. And then the next step, if you actually want to open the door, you're convinced enough to open the door, they have it so it, oh, there's a chain so it opens about 5 centimeters. So if they want to pass anything, but you don't open the door. They're so afraid. Deceit and violence, and no one can, it's just common. And deceit is in the very fabric of life. The politicians, everyone knows they're lying. Everyone knows they're self-interested. How or why the people vote for anyone is amazing. Because they're just expected that... you got it? It's just expected that the politicians will cheat. And they'll say one thing and do something else. And then... In the schools they teach as if they're convinced. They are convinced that men have descended from monkeys. And there's no... They call it scientific, but what in terms of what's supposed to be scientific, it's not at all scientific. Although they think it is. But because the atmosphere is one of falsity, then it's not that the science teachers or the writers of curricula are actually thinking we're going to cheat the people, but they're cheating themselves also, and they actually believe it's true that man is descended from monkeys, and there's scientific evidence. Because they're not saranga, they're not actually interested in finding the truth of the reality. Most people, instead of looking objectively for what's the truth, just like that's supposed to be the scientific method, but they just presume something to be right, first of all, and they proceed from there. What they think is right, and then they try to find the facts and figures, science or whatever, to fit their supposition or their doctrine, instead of objectively seeking for what is the truth, what is reality. They start at a midpoint. They start thinking, well, Jesus is the truth, the way, and the life, for instance, and therefore they bend all facts and information and overlook the problems, the clear problems with the accepting the Bible as truth. For instance, there are so many contradictions which are not really resolvable. I mean, we have contradictions in Shastra, in Vedic Shastra, but they can be explained. But in the Christian tradition, the kind of contradictions they have, they're not explainable. Just like, for instance, I don't want to get into a big thing here, but different Gospels describe Jesus, the different number of his ancestors in the line from David, and different names, and it's not reconcilable. But that's why they warn people that don't study the Bible. They warn Christians, don't take up deep Bible study in not under the objective manner, because if you do, then you'll find out there are so many problems which are just not explainable in realistic terms. Another example, this Dr. Sakya, what's his name? Sakya Naik. He's just such a bluffer. Promotes false information. And people, they become converted to Islam on the basis of this, because they don't look to see if it's actually true or if there's more to be understood about this. People take things at face value very superficially. And therefore it's easy to cheat them. The whole advertising industry, as I've said many times, It just works on the basis that people are stupid, they're easily cheatable, and they actually like to be cheated. Otherwise, if anyone exercised their human intelligence, if they actually thought about it a little bit, they would understand that the soap advertisement showing that by using this particular brand of soap, you'll become extraordinarily happy and your cloth will be much whiter than anyone else's and life will just become absolutely blissful as they portray in the soap adverts, that it's just a bunch of baloney. It's not a fact. And that this is being portrayed on the TV or the newspaper or whatever because the soap company paid money to put that in. And it's not like it's an actual fact. It's just it's a deliberate non-fact which is being promoted as fact. But people don't think, oh, this soap must be very good. I saw it on TV. It says very good. So they buy it. It works. The advertising industry is a multi-billion dollar industry which works on the supposition that people are superficial. They're not interested in understanding the actual reality. If you put an advertisement which just shows the one soap, the qualities of it against another, then people aren't even going to look at it. But if you put the advertisement with the soap with a housewife looking extremely blissful because she's using the soap that's being advertised, whereas another housewife standing next to her is looking morose because she doesn't use it. And then that will have more effect than, even if your soap is the best, and of course only one of them can be the best, but even if you show the qualities in an objective manner, it won't have as much effect in promoting sales as the bluffing advert. Bluffing works better. So, why not bluff? Devotees are like Parikshit Maharaj, realists. They should not be on the superficial platform. They should find out what is the reality. That is the purpose of human life. Atato brahma jignyasa. One should inquire into the ultimate reality. It's very difficult for even people to think of this because they're so superficial that they can get fooled by a tire advertisement or a soap advertisement. They can't even understand reality on the superficial platform. Reality in the world of illusion. Then how are they going to go beyond the world of illusion? And they don't. Generally people don't. People don't think about what is the ultimate purpose of life. They don't even think about it. They go through their whole life and never even think, what is the purpose of life? It just doesn't occur to them. So they're just like animals. Because urge to understand what is actually reality, then human life and animal life, there's very little difference. It's simply ahara nidra bhaya maithunam cha samanam etat pashubhyanaranam. Humans and animals eat, sleep, mate and defend, so what's the difference? Two-legged animal. There's no search for anything beyond the bodily need. Of course, humans, they may have art and science, intellectual activities, but unless they go beyond the superficial, studying, science is studying matter and art is manipulating matter for the satisfaction of the mind. But is that the ultimate reality? Can we not go further? Manasas tu pura buddhe, yo buddhe paratas tu saha. Beyond the mind is the intelligence. Beyond the intelligence is the soul. that the superficiality of the modern age of Kali Yuga is so intense that they promote that simply the body and the mind, and that's all I know. And even they study psychology, instead of seeing that the mind is a principle dependent on the soul, they say that it's produced from the body, from matter. So, very gross and again superficial. Vedic psychology understands that the soul is the basis and it has to be free from the pushings of the mind, to control the mind and transcend the mundane proclivities of the mind and come to the spiritual platform. But in mundane psychology, it's simply how to adjust the mind so you can get on with enjoying sense gratification. It comes down to the bodily plane. It doesn't go up to the spiritual level. It comes down to the gross sensual platform. So it's an age of ubiquitous. That means all-pervading. Superficiality. Falsity. Kaleya dosha nidhe rajan. This superficiality. Do you know what that means, superficial? It means just taking things at face value on the surface without going deeply into understanding what is the essence. So it's all pervading. We see in relationships also that people, relationships in the modern age have become superficial to a large extent. That people, they don't care for each other. They'll say, when you're walking on the street, they might say, hello, who are you? But they won't stop to listen to what the reply is. And the reply is a stock reply anyway. Yes, yes, I'm very good. They don't really care how you... I mean, even if they say that, that's quite a step up from the all-pervading total impersonalism. But it's not that they really care. It's just a hangover from an old tradition or something. When you see someone, how are you? And you stop to think about how to reply. And in the meantime, you look around and the person's already 50 meters down the road the other way. So in deep impersonalism. Yeah, in relationships also, in the Western world, people get married and it's... But they're practically, kalyanam, but it's not kalyan. Kalyana means that which is auspicious, but the marriage is not auspicious. It's like marrying dogs or something in some as described in Navadvipa at the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The people just for fun, some people they would marry dogs with a big ceremony. Just, you know what for? Just for fun, that's all. You know, well, they might have ascribed some pseudo-spiritual meaning to it. But, there's no real intent to commit themselves to each other throughout life. It's just, okay, we're married, see how it goes. Try it out. Then after a few years, or a few months, or a few days, well, okay, time to move on. Find another husband, find another wife, that's all. So most superficial. So devotees, they have to be sarabhuk. That is the meaning of a devotee, one who looks for the essence. Not content with superficiality. It may be difficult because in the modern age, superficiality is all pervading, as I've attempted to describe somewhat. And people then, they come to Krishna consciousness, but they're not used to going very deeply or trying to understand what is the essence. And therefore, it's very easy to be cheated, even in the name of Krishna consciousness. Someone smiles at you, and you think, oh, especially if they have this kind of sadhu, you know, mystical sadhu smile. I don't know how to imitate it exactly, but I mean, maybe you know what I'm talking about. This gazing into, looking up, you should be looking up, like gazing into the distance with glazed eyes, as if they're only partially here in this world, but actually they're looking up, or some look. It's looking what sadhu is expected to be, making a good show. So people tend to think, if people, if they can look like that, well, they must be really advanced. Or if they smile at you, they have a big name and position, they must be great sadhus. But one should be sarabhuk, look for the essence. Don't just take it very superficially. Of course, not everyone can take to Krishna consciousness like this. Most people are superficial. So it's difficult to give the real thing to people who are accustomed to falsity, who are accustomed to not making the effort to go very deeply. People are easily cheated by this soap, and they don't think, well, is it actually the best buy for me? Is it actually good quality? Or is it such a high price? You may think it's a high price because it's better soap, but then if you think about it, well, maybe it's a high price because they spend so much money on advertising it. So I'm paying for their advertisement, by which they tell me to buy it. So if you think about it, we don't want to think. Okay, I saw it on TV. It must be good. And they buy it. So people are accustomed to superficiality. So it may be easier to preach Krishna consciousness to people in a superficial way. That, well, you chant Hare Krishna and you see all your financial problems will be solved, your legal problems will be solved, your social problems will be solved, and this and that. Life will become much better. And people, they like that. And then they maybe chant with great, you know, a lot of feeling, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And they're thinking, oh, all that money I'm going to get, and, you know, my enemy will be vanquished. And they're not calling for Krishna. So it may be easier to preach Krishna consciousness like that, but the problem is that it's not Krishna consciousness. It's not. Krishna consciousness means to understand what is real, beginning with, we're not the body. So if we attempt to preach Krishna consciousness on the basis of some bodily benefit, then we're not preaching Krishna consciousness. It's superficial. It's not the real thing. We're not giving people the real thing. People come to us, oh, I have so many problems. We tell them, of course you have problems. It's because you're not Krishna conscious. You don't understand what the reality is. The whole material world is the world of problems. And people don't want to hear this. They want to. It's too much for them to think about. They're not used to thinking. And they just want to hear how I can be happy on the bodily platform. If you can help me, good. If not, well, next stop is Sai Baba. He has a good reputation for helping people. So, you know, if your Krishna can't help, then try somewhere else. Zakir Naik, you know, sounds convinced. Sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So I'll go there. People don't want to take the real thing, so we may think that, well, okay, we'll give them what they want. We'll give them Krishna in the way they want, but Krishna is not obliged to dance to our tune. He is the flute player. We have to dance to his tune. Not that we convert Krishna in what we want him to be, and then we present Krishna. This is Krishna, and this is the person who solves all your material problems and makes life great and kills all your enemies and gives you plenty of the best soap, and then your wife doesn't complain. This is Krishna. But that's not Krishna. So we're telling people, take to Krishna consciousness, this is Krishna. But we're not actually giving Krishna. It's just, again, the word superficial. We don't go deeply, because why? People, they're not capable, and they're not interested, they're afraid. If we tell them, Krishna, he's a long way. You start with Bhagavad Gita philosophy. You're not the body. This body is not you. This wife is not your wife. This house is not your wife. Then what are you talking about? Of course I'm the body. Of course, I mean, what are you saying it's not my wife? I've been married to her for 12 years. And this is my house. Don't have to say it's not my house. What are you trying to do? Cheat me or something? Of course this is reality. What are you talking about? The spiritual world? I never saw any such thing. What are you talking about? Let's be realistic here. So it's very difficult to convince people who are entrenched in falsity. Who asatyare satya karimani. This ahankare mattohaya nitai pada pasarya asatyare satya karimani. Due to ahankar, identification of that which is not themselves with themselves, and the false pride which stems from that, then they forget Nityananda, and they take that which is unreal to be real. So you may think it's a better policy for preaching Krishna consciousness just to tell people that all your material problems will be solved, but it doesn't work, because Krishna consciousness is not so superficial. It's not nothing to do with this material world. Krishna consciousness is on the spiritual platform. We have to come to the spiritual platform. And simply to pretend that we are presenting Krishna consciousness, again, it's not Krishna consciousness. So devotees, they have to seek out the real. Devotees, they want the real truth, real love, real beauty, not this false love. False love is very easy. You smile at people and you talk about compassion. You open up some home for the poor, feed them, open up a hospital, some school teaching them how to get a job and get ahead in this world. So this appears to be love. You see, we're loving all the people of the world. We're helping them, but it's all superficial. It doesn't help them at all, ultimately. In the ultimate sense, which is the only real sense, opening schools and hospitals and teaching people mundane subjects, it doesn't actually help them in any way whatsoever. So if we think that this is love, this is compassion, however much we talk about love and compassion, if we don't know what real love and real compassion is, then there's no question of having real love or compassion. It'll just be a sham in the name of love or compassion. So I become suspicious when I hear people talk about love a lot, because it sounds to me like all these bogus people just talk about love. But real love is demonstrated in action, based on knowledge of what is actual love. It's easy to talk about love. Oh, you just feel love. In Indian marriages, at least previously, they never spoke about love. It was just the man does his duty, the woman does her duty, they work together, and that's it. No need to talk about love, because it's manifest in their activities. Whereas in the Western world, man and the wife have to keep on telling each other 10 times a day, I love you, I love you, I love you, and then they divorce anyway, because they have no idea what actual love is. Actual love means for Krishna, but even on the mundane platform, there's the perverted reflection of that. And there's not even perverted reflection, just completely hollow. It's just nothing there, just the word, which is a meaningless word. So devotees, they're interested in reality. And reality means, first of all, we have to understand the ultimate reality, without understanding which there's no real love, there's no real beauty, there's no real truth. Srimad Bhagavatam presents that. Satyam param dhimahi. We meditate on the supreme truth. And dharma kaitava. Dharma projata kaitava atra. All cheating religion is herein kicked out. It's not allowed. There's no place in here. So, what is the essence? Devotees should be looking for that. Don't be satisfied. We should not be satisfied with anything less than complete surrender to Krishna, and that which helps us to surrender to Krishna. If we take it that the success of our life is that we got a big position in ISKCON, or we got a nice comfortable room, in which we do a little service and we go back to our nice comfortable room and we live comfortably. And that's not Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness means to fully give ourselves to Krishna. That's the meaning of love, when we fully give ourselves without any personal desire. Of course, devotees desire to please Krishna and that Krishna is pleased with them. Krishna is this supreme lovable object. He's actually the only lovable object. Actual love is only with Krishna. So that love is properly placed. First of all, before we talk about love, we should find who is the proper person to love. If we love our dog, the dog will reciprocate by licking us and other such dog-like activities. But the dog, his ability to help us and reciprocate with us is limited, and it's also limited by time. Our dear beloved dog, eventually, dehantara prapti, gets another body. And we also get another body. We become a dog because we're so attached to our dog. So we should find out who is the actual object of love. And what does it mean to love Krishna? How can we? What does it mean to love Krishna? It means to act in a way that Krishna is pleased, and with the attitude that he will be pleased. Just like two people can offer arati to Krishna and do more or less exactly the same thing. One pleases Krishna, the other doesn't please Krishna, because one is doing it simply as a ritual, and the other is doing it with the great desire to please Krishna. So it's not just the activity also. What do I have to do to be Krishna conscious? Well, get up in the morning, go to Mangalati, chant your rounds, this, that. Okay, that's good, that's a good start. But now, what is our motive? What do we want? We should want only to please Krishna. So people are on the superficial platform. All they can think of is how I can please myself. And they think that's all in all. That's all there is in life. And therefore everyone's fighting because no one's together because they're all thinking how we can please ourselves. It makes a big competition. Of course, people sometimes come together as a out of convenience, one family, if we all work together, then it's convenient for our sense gratification. Or one nation, we're all together, we're all united to fight the enemy. That's Machiavellian politics that always promote that there's an enemy who's about to attack. We have a great enemy. So that will unite the people. Otherwise, they'll be scheming and politicking against the king. Because they're going to fight someone. If they're not in the mood of fighting an external enemy, then they'll be fighting among themselves and they'll be plotting against the king. So it's required for a state to have enemies in this age. They have allies and enemies, and that can change. Who is an ally can be an enemy overnight, and vice versa. Because there's no substantial platform. It's all based on self-interest. In most cases, the interest of the leaders rather than the actual interest of the country. So, what's the essence of this class? The essence is find the essence. Krishna is the essence of everything. To find Him, we can't find Him in a cartoon of Krishna. We won't find, now there are Krishna cartoons. We won't find Krishna in any cartoon. We won't find Krishna, where will we, anywhere else except where? In the heart of the devotee. Sadhava hridayam mahyam, sadhu nang hridayam tvaham, madanyat tena jananti nahang tebya managapi. Krishna says, devotees are in my heart and I am their heart. Actually, he says, the devotees are my heart and they are my heart because I know nothing but them and they know nothing but me. So, this we should search for. Don't get stuck on the platform of mundane religiosity in the name of Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna. Any question about this, please? No, no question. It's all clear. You have a question? You're waiting to see if anyone else has a question. Okay, all right.
When you raised the question, that seems like that actually all these points explained together as in, but without association with the bonds to what it, without the service to the Guru, actually we can't solve them.
Yeah, Gokulchand Prabhu is making the point that we cannot attain the essence without association of advanced devotees. And what did you say? Surrender to the Guru? Yeah. That's the process. That's so I finished the class saying that we, the devotees, they have found the essence. They have entered the heart of Krishna. So, they can take us there. But not by our own effort alone. Yeah, so that's the point you're making. Is there any question on the basis of that? Not now. That's another class, maybe. Yeah.
How it really works that unless we become completely purified and our heart becomes purified, Krishna doesn't come there. It's just like that. Krishna doesn't come in our heart.
Krishna doesn't come in our heart unless we're completely purified. Well, He's already there, but He doesn't manifest Himself unless we're purified. What does that mean? That we're going on with Krishna consciousness and we're chanting and chanting and almost getting pure, and all of a sudden, boom! Well, it might be like that. With Dhruv Maharaj, it worked like that, right? He was doing his austerity, and then Krishna showed Narad Muni also. Krishna showed Himself. But otherwise, there are stages. Ado Shraddha Tata Sadhu Sangha Tato Narata Nivritti Set Tato Nishta Ruchistata Ata Saktis Tata Bhava Ata Premabhyudanchati Sadakana Mayang Prena Pradur Bhave Bhavet Kramaha. Krama means step. Step by step. Gradually. Beginning with fragile faith. Then we associate with devotees, engage in the activities of devotional service, and then we come to what seems like the plateau, the long plateau of anartha nivritti. But then we become fixed. We become attached to Krishna. Then we experience ecstasy. And then full love of Krishna. So this is the process of sadhana, of gradual process. But there's some, even at the beginning, some, at least some modicum of the result is experienced even in the beginning. The essence of Krishna Prem, of course, that can be taken in different perspectives. The essence is the selfless serving mode, but from another perspective, the experience of Prem is one of extreme bliss. But one gets some modicum of of that experience even in the beginning. Otherwise, how could one go on and want to advance further? If you're not getting the same, if one is cultivating detachment from gross sense gratification and actually stopping activities of gross sense gratification, the jiva is by nature always blissful and always desirous of being happy. So if there was no happiness in Krishna consciousness, then how could anyone go on with the process of sadhana? So that happiness is at least a sample of the happiness of pure devotional service. So Krishna, yeah, he manifests to the extent that we surrender. Yayata mang prapadyante tangs to taiva pajami aham. It's not that we have to be totally pure before we have it. Otherwise, we have no idea about Krishna. We just have to wait to become totally pure. I mean, there may be some statement like that in Shastra, but everything has to be understood. Therefore, we have to take different statements together and harmonize them and understand them in context. That is required. Harmonization of apparently conflicting statements. Anything else? Yeah.
Just a small comment regarding this. I think it's a very appropriate example of a soap.
The example of soap, yeah.
Because actually, if people would just know, majority of people, from what substance the soap is made,
if they knew what soap was made from,
they would just stop using it.
They'd stop using it.
Because it's made from, you know, in this, there is a called the industry, capillary industry.
Which industry?
Capillary. They are collecting all the.
Capillary?
Capillary. This is.
Capillary.
Yeah. This is. They're collecting.
Capillary industry collects all the.
Intestines from the.
The intestines from the.
Slaughterhouses.
From the slaughterhouses. Hooves, yeah.
This material they're putting in the big. You know, barrels and cooking it, and then.
Oh, I see. It's extracted from all this.
Yeah, and then
the hooves and intestines of animals. But it can also, soap can also be made from like other things, like. Generally, it's made from animal substances. Although Navi Yogendra Swami told me a few years ago that he'd done some checking, and most of the soaps in India are made from vegetarian substances. That's what he told me. I don't know if it's true.
There were no slaughterhouses.
There were no slaughterhouses at that time. There weren't many.
In Europe, you can.
Now there are plenty of slaughterhouses in India. They've made progress to hell. Oh. Well, then we should check out. This Chandrika soap is supposed to be vegetarian. This Mysore sandal. These two. Yeah. Hmm? Medimix.
They put the cream
to show that it's not made with animal products. It's worth checking it out. You know, what tooth? What are you putting in your mouth when you brush your teeth? Better don't put something made from animal bones or whatever.
In cosmetics, you know, in the cosmetic industry, most of the
cosmetic industry is heavily reliant on the slaughterhouses. Yeah.
So you know, ladies are putting on this.
They put lipstick, and it's ladies. You better you use this kajal and mehendi. This traditional. And this lipstick is, you know, I don't know what it's made from. There's a company in the West which started in Brighton in England, I believe, called The Body Shop, which has become big, I think, all over the Western world. And their principle is that they don't use any animal products. So that's a big, but it's a cosmetics. It's a they make cosmetics and all this. So
we notice sometimes in the Croatia, you just drive on this on the road, and this jack who is collecting, you know, this,
oh,
Hare
Krishna,
goes, you know, on the road, and it just, you know, it's
stinks.
It's horrible. It's horrible. Obviously. You can't imagine such a.
They take the essence of the bones and everything, yeah. We say take the essence, we should know what to take the essence of. The cosmetic industry takes the essence of the bones and intestines and turns that into the lipstick, which will make the lady look very pretty. Yeah, Chitta Hari. Toshan Krishna Prabhu. Yeah. In this world, there is a lot of cheaters and cheating. Yep, that's unquestionable. Specifically in business? Well, yeah, it's most apparent there, although it's everywhere, yeah.
So there is some cheating to survive in the business.
To survive in the business, you have to cheat. What should you do? Give 50% of your income to you, and you can use it in Krishna's service. Prabhupada mentions that in the Bhagavad Gita purport. In business you have to lie. Otherwise you can't make any profit. Without profit, there's no business. It's just a necessity of the modern age. We also do. We lie and cheat as required. Every time I go to Dubai, I dress in kami clothes and pretend I'm not a sannyasi. Sometimes they ask you, what have you come for? I said, just for a visit. I don't tell them I'm coming to preach Krishna consciousness. So that's one form of cheating, and that's required for Krishna's service. So in business, that's if at all one's going to do business, generally some cheating is required. Actually, not in all businesses. Jashamati Nandam Prabhu told me there's one travel agent in Ahmedabad who's become quite successful because he tells people, look, this is what I'm going to charge you for the ticket. This is what the company takes. This is the taxes. This is my profit. He tells them. And it's actually become quite successful. So it's not necessarily in all businesses that there is cheating, but in many of them. And if you're in a line that requires that, then you may have to do so. But then, Prabhupada said, he gave the example of the Marwaris in one conversation. He said, in business they cheat like anything. But then they know they have to give charity, otherwise they'll be implicated in sinful activities. Therefore they build temples like this. In Calcutta, and used to be so many Marwaris. And, you know, from the very beginning they supported our activities. They're charitably inclined. Yeah, anything else?
Yes, in Ajayas, we see that devotees were promoting the slogan, chant and be high forever.
In the early days of ISKCON, devotees were propagating a slogan, chant and be high forever. Something like that, yeah. Be high forever. Stay high forever, yeah.
It's kind of material.
It gives an apparently material motivation. Well, the motivation is to be happy. And when they explain it, we also say chant Hare Krishna and be happy. And people might take that as mundane happiness. When you explain it, then people can understand that then high means to be intoxicated on some drug like LSD, which is very popular at that time in America. Now they've gone on to other things. I understand it's not so popular these days. And the idea is you take it and you feel, there's a feeling, if things go as hoped, then there's a feeling of euphoria. Like you're feeling like you're floating in the sky or something like that. So, but then you come down. That's when the effect wears off, they say, now you came down. So they said, Krishna consciousness means staying high forever. So they represented Krishna consciousness in the terms that the hippies could understand. But they weren't actually promising any mundane benefit to them. So that kind of thing you can say. Stay high forever. Chant Hare Krishna and be happy. You can say that. But that doesn't mean that our whole preaching begins and ends with some three-word slogan. Stay high forever. There's a lot more, but that's just like to attract people. But if that's our whole preaching, then we're in trouble. We have to preach more. Explain things. Okay, anything else? Otherwise, we'll finish. And Hare Krishna.